I call Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Friday, February 6, 2026, and the time is 3:30 p.m. Please turn off your cell phones. Committee members present today, Senator Rauscher, Senator Dunbar, Senator Myers, Senator Klayman, and Vice Chair Senator Wilikowski. I'm Senator Giesel. We have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you to Heather and Susan, who are keeping the minutes and helping us out with the audio. We have two things on today's agenda. You may have seen Senate Bill 180, LNG import facilities. That bill is being set aside today. We're going to prioritize Senate Bill 227, the title of which is Tax Compact, Sales Tax, and Oil and Gas Tax. We are asking the Department of Revenue to prioritize two sections of Senate Bill 227, that being the section on the corporate tax and on oil and gas tax. So for committee members and for the public, those will be the sections they begin with. If we have time at the end, we can certainly go back to sales tax. So I would welcome today Janelle Earls. She is the acting commissioner of the Department of Revenue. Brandon Spanos is the acting tax director, Department of Revenue. And Dan Stickle is the chief economist, Department of Revenue. So I will invite you forward to the table, whoever is going to do the presenting here. Committee members, we are going to wait until the end of the section, the topic. So first is the corporate tax, I believe, in the order of the slides, to take questions, okay, so that they can complete the whole topic and then take our questions. So welcome. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Chair Giesel and members of the committee. My name is Janelle Earls. I'm the Acting Commissioner and Administrative Services Director for the Department of Revenue. Here with me today is Acting Tax Director Brandon Spanos and Chief Economist Dan Stickle. We are here today to introduce the Governor's Tax Bill, House Bill 284. As you had stated, Chair Giesel, we have a pretty long presentation, and we'll try to get through each slide as quickly as we can.
I would just amend one of your comments, and that is that it's Senate Bill 227.
Sorry.
No worries. It's okay. No problem.
All right. I had that memorized from yesterday. I apologize. So this presentation will first go through policy goals, talk about each component of the bill, then if there's time, move on to the fiscal note and sectional analysis. The governor's policy goals are to provide a plan for fiscal stability, limit spending, improve Alaska's long-term appeal for families and businesses to ensure a predictable PFD, and require agency operations be reviewed on a regular basis. And slide five is the fiscal plan in more detail. I don't feel like I need to read it to everybody. And now I will turn the presentation over to professionals from our tax division, Acting Director Spanos and Chief Economist Stickle. Each have 20 years of experience in our tax division and are well suited to answer your questions on tax.
Thank you, Commissioner.
So Chair Giesel, for the record, Brandon Spanos, Acting Director with the Tax Division. And I'll just pull this a little bit closer. I've been kind of trying to get over a cold here, so my voice is a little lower than normal, which I'm told is hard to pick up on these mics. So I'll try to make sure everyone can hear me. So the omnibus bill has three main components. First is the first in our slides, but we're going to skip for today, is a proposed seasonal sales tax. Second, updates to the and eventual elimination of the corporate income tax. And third, two changes to the oil and gas production tax. The first of that is the raising of the floor, the minimum floor from 4 to 6, and adding a new fee for the pipeline corridor maintenance. And so we'll go through the corporate income tax changes first, and then the oil and gas, and whether you want to go to the fiscal note or back, we'll see where we're at that point. And thank you for, as you mentioned, holding questions until we're done with each section, as I'm sure that it's hard to get through the whole section otherwise.
And while you're pausing, I want to welcome Senator Kawasaki, who arrived several minutes ago. Thanks. And just reviewing for committee members who might have been slightly late, we're going to wait till the end of the section to ask questions. So we're going to slide 18. Is that correct?
Correct.
Excellent.
So there are two proposed changes to the corporate income tax. First is modernizing the sourcing rules, and then to take the rate to zero in 2031. So moving on to slide 20. This slide provides some history for the corporate income tax. And if you want me to speed up, just let me know, because there is a lot of history here. The tax itself dates pre-statehood to 1949. The tax rate was 10% of the federal tax liability for individuals and businesses. And then in 1959, we adopted the Uniform Division of Income for Tax Purposes Act, which tax professionals called UDIPTA. So if I refer to it as that, that's what I'm talking about. And that is incorporated into our statutes in 43-19. In 1970, Alaska adopted the Multi-State Tax Compact, which is that 43-19 that I just talked about, which is the restatement of UDIPTA with some minor changes, establishes standards for three-factor apportionment of property, payroll, and sales. And in 1975, Alaska tax was repealed and re-implemented with major revisions. It adopted the Internal Revenue Code by reference. So basically, instead of defining the entire income in the state in the state law, we piggyback the federal tax code, which is what most states do, and we set our own rates. Alaska's rate was 5.4% plus 4% surtax based on Alaska's taxable income and not federal tax liability. This is called rolling conformity. So some states have static conformity where they adopt a specific date and time for the Internal Revenue Code. We went with rolling conformity, which examples include changes that can happen at the federal level, depreciation schedule, treatment, and net operating losses. There were additional major changes that came in 1978 through 1981. Alaska was flush with oil money and debate on over how to tax the oil companies and share wealth with people ensued. In 1978, we enacted separate accounting for oil and gas on the corporate income tax level, still just for C corporations, passed through entities were not an issue at the time. We didn't have any pass-through entities at the in the oil and gas corporations. In 1980, Alaska was flush with oil money, and we repealed the individual income tax, and that's where the pass-throughs would have been captured anyway. And since S-corps flow through to individual tax returns, this effectively created an exemption for S-corps from the corporate income tax. Separate accounting was repealed effective January 1 of 1982. And set up a current worldwide apportionment with 9.4% top rate. There was a legal challenge to separate accounting that went to the courts, and the state ultimately prevailed in 1985 in the Supreme Court, but the state kept the apportionment methodology that we had established with the three apportionment formula for the oil and gas companies. In 2014, current tax brackets were established, the top rate being 9.4%, and it remains until now. That now applies to income over $222,000 versus $90,000 previously. So thank you for bearing with me on that slide. We're now on slide 21. Looking at our current tax situation, generally Alaska follows the Internal Revenue Code when determining an entity's taxable nexus and status. Alaska has no personal income tax. The state's corporate income tax applies only to C corporations. And for non-petroleum corporations, corporate income tax is based on a water's edge activity, which really just means the U.S. nation. We add up all the income from all affiliated entities in the United States and apportion based on property, payroll, and sales. Our corporate income tax for oil and gas is based on the worldwide apportionment of income and is based on property, production, and sales. So we took out the payroll and replaced it with production for oil companies. Several tax brackets, and we'll show those on the next slide. I'll just go there now. With the top being 9.4%, and you can see that's graduated rates with a zero bracket for anything less than $25,000 of taxable income. And moving on to slide 23, this is the main change in the bill. Our current sourcing rules are cost of performance, which are in our statutes, and then we have regulations on them as well. What cost of performance really means is that you would source your sales for the sales factor. So the factors are, what do you have in Alaska versus what do you have everywhere else? So for an oil company, that would be worldwide sales. So your sales, most cost of performance isn't going to be really oil and gas. So for a C corporation doing business in Alaska, their sales in Alaska over their sales everywhere in the U.S. And cost of performance looks at where your cost center is. So if your cost center is in another state, you would source sales made into Alaska to that other state. And most states have moved to market-based sourcing. Most UDIPA states have moved to market-based sourcing, and that's what's being proposed in this bill. That modernizes the sourcing rules and apportions the sales in the numerator to the sale where the market is, so basically where the customer is located. And for this mostly applies to internet-type businesses, streaming services, online sales, things like that, or historically that were thought of as mail-order type of businesses. And that's when cost performance really was created, in the mail-order time period. We're in a new world, and market-based sourcing makes a lot more sense. So moving on to the next slide, 24. Moving to market-based sourcing would modernize our corporate income tax and capture sales that are currently reported to other states. This is an approach that acknowledges the realities of today's modern world and how goods and services are often bought and sold online. The cost of performance model no longer makes sense as a sourcing rule for the sales. This proposal does not include the separate carve-out of highly digitized businesses that was in SB 113 and is in another bill, which number I'd have to look up, I apologize, but another one that's been introduced recently in the Senate, and or I believe maybe it's in the House now that I think about it, but one that looks very similar and has that highly digitized portion. This does not. This proposes is a market-based sourcing approach that in this bill it would capture sales of highly digitized businesses, but it would not set a single sales factor for those businesses. So a business that met the definition in that bill would still be apportioning its sales to Alaska if it was only apportioning to another state under cost of performance today. Moving to slide 25, the revenue impact is estimated to be around $15 million. There is a range, and that's the midpoint in that range that we chose for this fiscal note. The governor wanted a hard number in our fiscal note, so we picked that, but it is a range and there is some uncertainty. There will be winners and losers with this approach. So what companies would pay more tax under this approach? Multi-state companies in technology, professional services and finance, transportation and e-commerce businesses delivering goods and service into Alaska. Primarily, these are lower 48 companies with little or no physical presence in Alaska. And then what companies would be paying less? These would be companies with physical presence in Alaska, but a few Alaskan customers. So these are Alaska-based businesses servicing mostly out-of-state customers. And then for no change, this would be Alaska-based companies that are doing business solely in Alaska. They wouldn't have any effect to this cost performance change to market-based sourcing. And moving, this is our last slide under the corporate income tax section. Moving to slide 26, this bill proposes to reduce the tax rate to zero in 2031. The governor believes that having a lower corporate income tax rate will increase investment in Alaska. And currently, Alaska is the fourth highest corporate income tax in the nation. By reducing the tax rate to zero, we become more competitive to see corporations looking to do business investments in Alaska. And this is consistent with the governor's fiscal plan. And I will pause there for questions on the corporate income tax.
Thank you. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. Do you have a sense, if we were to go to a single sales factor for highly digitized businesses, how much that would raise?
We do. We have a fiscal note for the previous SB 113 and the current version that looks similar. And that range, I believe, is 25 to 60. 25 to 65 million is the range. And again, if we were to put a midpoint to that, we'll keep that range for that, because it is a bit more uncertain in that highly digitized space, since we don't have other states that we can look at and try to assist with.
Follow up?
Is that on top of what you expect your changes in this bill to do, on top of the 15, 16 million?
So through the chair, Vice Chair Wilkowski, the 15 million is also in that span of 25 to 65.
Yes, follow-up. Senator Wilkowski.
Some legislators have suggested that we go to a single sales factor for all non-oil and gas corporations in Alaska, and I'm curious your thoughts on that and what the revenue impact of that would be, if you have any sense.
So through the chair, Vice Chair Wilkowski, a single sale so a lot of states have gone to a single sales factor. It was popular at one time to go to double and triple weighted sales factors and keep the other two factors, and then they eventually said, why are we doing triple weighted sales factor? Let's just throw out the other two factors and go to single sales factor. The intent behind that was to encourage businesses that were in a neighboring state to move their headquarters to your state. Mm-hmm. Or maybe the company was talking about opening a very large warehouse or a new they were going to build a skyscraper and were like, trying to encourage that particular company to come to your state. If you had a single sales factor under cost of performance, it made a lot of sense. With only a single sales factor, it made a lot of sense to have that company based in your state, because you've had no property or payroll that would hurt your factor. And so if all other states remained under the three-factor formula, that one state would be very enticing. What happened was all the states around them did the same thing, and it was a race to the bottom. In Alaska, we still have a lot of property and payroll for large businesses, especially certain industries like oil and gas and mining, fishing. To me personally, it doesn't make a lot of sense to go to a single sales factor, but certainly that's something that you could consider. And what it would do to the revenue, I'm sure we've modeled that, but do you have an idea off the top of your head on what that would be?
Dan Stickle, Chief Economist, for the record, to Senator Wilkowski through the chair. We have looked at the revenue impacts of single sales factor. It would not be an increase to revenue. It would be either neutral or a decrease. And like Acting Director Spanos said, that has to do with kind of the concentration of these companies, particularly in the resource industries that are heavy on property and payroll and light on sales in the state.
Further questions? Senator Klayman.
Just so I have a clear distinction, there's parts of what is in the governor's proposal that was in Senate Bill 113 that he vetoed. Tell me what is in the governor's proposal that was in 113, and what is in 113 that is not in the governor's proposal, and then as part of that, the cost difference, or not the cost, but the revenue difference between those.
Sure, through the chair, Senator Klayman, the parts that from 113 that are in this bill are the majority of the sections, because most of the sections were making changes to Alaska Statutes 4319, where the multi-state tax compact lives. Those were updating those different words in order to change from cost of performance to market-based sourcing, and update also modernize some of the language. So instead of business income, it's apportionable income. So most of if you look at the number of pages and the number of words on the two bills, the majority of those are kept. But what's not kept are just is one main section, which is going to a single sales factor for highly digitized businesses. And so that that is not in the governor's bill. The difference in the revenue, maybe I'll pass that over to Dan, because I can't remember the range for the market-based sourcing.
Sure. Again, Dan Stickle for the record, to Senator Klayman through the chair. So for the Senate Bill 113 with the highly digitized plus the market-based sourcing, we had estimated a range of $25 to $65 million of incremental revenue, with the midpoint being $45 million. And of that, in that midpoint, It's about one-third market-based sourcing, so $15 million, and about two-thirds of the highly digitized, which would be the $30 million. And so I think for the higher and the lower end of the range, if you think in terms of about two-thirds of the impact of 113 was the highly digitized component, and about one-third is the market-based sourcing, that's a good rule of thumb.
Follow-up?
So the Senate Bill 113, the midpoint is $45 million, and the first 15 of that is the market-based sourcing, and the second two-thirds, the next $30 million, is coming from the highly digitized businesses.
Senator Klayman, through the chair, that's correct.
And do you have any – does the governor have a reason why he didn't include the highly digitized businesses?
So through the chair, Senator Klayman, what I know is what he wrote in his veto, which is that he believed that a portion of the bill was potentially unconstitutional. And I can only imagine that he meant the highly digitized, since that's not what he did not include that portion in his bill.
Follow up, Senator Klayman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's totally different. So when this is about C corporations, how many total business entities do we have, that at least from the Department of Revenue's perspective, how many business entities do we actually have in the state, and how many of those are C corporations?
Senator Klayman, through the chair, again, Dan Stickle for the record. So we have, according to our most recent data of corporate tax filing, there were about 19,000 tax filers. Of those, about 6,000 were C corporations. And of those, about 1,270 had a tax liability to the state.
So we follow
up? Follow-up, Senator Klayman.
So in rough terms, about a third of the corporate entities that are the taxable entities that revenue is aware of are C corporations, but only 1,200 of those actually pay taxes to the state. Of those, why do so many not pay taxes to the state?
Sure. Senator Klayman, through the chair. So the S corporations have a filing requirement with the state, but they are not, we don't apply a tax to them. We also have homeowners associations that are required to file a return with the state. The ones that would have a tax liability fall into that first $25,000 of taxable income bracket that has a 0% tax rate. And then for the corporations that do have a positive taxable income, that's about 2,800 of the 6,000 corporations in any given year. A little bit more than half of that fall into that first $25,000 bracket, which is essentially a small corporation exemption.
Follow up, Senator Klayman.
So does the 6,000 number include S corporations?
Senator Klayman, through the chair, so that is C corporations filing a tax return. And then on top of that, there's about 12,000 S corporations filing a tax return.
And are the S corporations all LLCs or different kinds of business entities?
Senator Klayman, through the chair, there would be different business entities that fall to the S corporation as their final filing status federally.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually wanted to go back a couple slides. When you initially started, you talked about the fiscal plan itself. On page 4 of the slides, it was just sort of a background of the plan. And I'm just curious how, because we're talking about the three elements of the revenue side of the picture, I think it's important. I'm glad that the governor has introduced revenue as part of this picture, because we have a multi-billion dollar deficit. We've lived with a multi-billion dollar deficit for 10 years. Why was it these three taxes that have been introduced, or these types of revenue measures that were introduced? Is it something that the governor came up with, his policy team? Did it come from Department of Revenue, Department of Natural Resources? I mean, which?
Through the chair to Senator Kawasaki, there were a lot of things modeled, a lot of different options modeled. And all of these items together on slide 4 bring together that balance of where we need to be.
And through the
pardon me, please go ahead.
Through the chair, I was just going to add, Senator Kawasaki, that ultimately was the governor's choice to put the fiscal plan together. Department of Revenue modeled many options, and the governor chose which options to go with.
Follow up, Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, not to defend big oil, but oil companies do pay a lot of taxes. When you look at the total revenues coming into the state, gross-wise, they're right around 13% of our entire income stream, revenue stream. But like mining's at 1%. Fisheries is even at smaller than that. Was there any thought to look at those, or were they looked at? Were they modeled?
Sure. Dan Stickle for the record, to Senator Kawasaki through the chair. So we have modeled and provided information about a wide variety of taxes, including what the impacts of changing any of the state's existing taxes would be, and a variety of new taxes. So those were all available for consideration.
Follow up.
Thank you. And so two out of these three is sort of modifying what's existing currently. The big one is the first part that we're not really talking about, the sales tax. That is one that particularly hits residents of the state versus the other two that don't. There was a recent ICER study just a couple weeks ago, and ICER said something to the effect that the easiest policy decision, or the, I can't remember exactly, not maybe not easiest was the word, but basically that oil and gas tax was sort of the where to look to try to solve the deficit and the fiscal gap. Was that taken into effect or concern with the governor's team?
As through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, again for the record, Brandon Spouse, acting director. You'll have to repeat the question after I just went through all
that. Thank you.
Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Director Spanos. It's the Institute of Social and Economic Research just gave that presentation a couple weeks ago to the legislators and the governor. It says that raising oil and corporate taxes is the least painful option to reduce Alaska's deficit. And there were a lot of different caveats to that. So was that part of the decision, and why was sales tax, which does not seem to be one of the least painful options to reducing the deficit, why was that part of the inclusion into this three-part system?
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki. I won't reintroduce myself so I don't forget the question. The ICER study was at the request of the governor, so certainly he knew what was in the study. He did consider all the results. He considered all the modeled and our own modeling, our own economic research group that Dan Stickle leads had very similar outcomes to the ICER study. So certainly that information was before him. Why he chose specifically a sales tax, it's as we stated before, there really is no fiscal solution that can make everyone happy. The governor felt that this was the best solution for the state.
Thank you.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll try to keep this quick because I do want to go on to the, I think, very interesting discussion about the oil taxes and the thing GVR that he has in here. But going back to Senator Klayman's question about the single sales factor and how we digitize businesses. I understand why we wouldn't want to do that with regards to the companies that have large presence here, like mining, oil, but there are almost no highly digitized companies that are headquartered here. And if 2/3 of the potential revenue of that change come from that portion, the single sales factor portion on digitized companies, I am puzzled as to why we wouldn't do it. I know that the governor said that it's unconstitutional, but I'm curious, do other states do it? That is, single sales factor as applied to highly digitized businesses, does that exist in any other states around the country?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, we did look and did fairly in-depth research on that and could not find any other state that had anything like that.
Interesting. So
follow up.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I guess we'll just, I'd like that in writing if possible, that research, because I'm surprised to hear that. And I want to know what other states are doing. You know, I think the number was 36 or 37 other states that are adopting a portion of this. But I think, are you saying that those states only did the market-based sourcing and not the single sales factor? Is that what your research has concluded?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, the market-based sourcing is, yeah, there's plenty of information out on that. The Multi-State Tax Commission has model language, and that's really where we started. So that language in the governor's bill and in SB 113 came from my staff. We've been asking for market-based sourcing for a while. It's been it taken up, and I believe the first time introduced was in SB 113, but now it's in the governor's bill. That's language that exists in other states, that the tax division has seen how cost of performance is, that we're not capturing sales to Alaska that we could with a simple change. The highly digitized piece, I'm not sure exactly who crafted that or where it came from.
You did.
and when you say you mean the executive branch, and I understand that that's possible, but I personally don't know who in the executive branch crafted that. It is unique to that bill, and so our research was really just looking at other states' statutes, and we didn't see anything that referenced highly digitized business. So there, what I would give you was pretty much an email that says we looked at all the states and didn't find that language anywhere.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So go back to the ICER study, and Mr. Stickle, I wasn't aware you had your own modeling version as well, so I'd like to hear if this lines up. But from what I remember from both the presentation and then I had some of the gentlemen come speak to me in my office. In the short term, the effects on the job losses were the least coming from the corporate taxes, but the effects over the long term, they were some of the worst. It looked like, according to their modeling, when they went out to 2050, that if you had a sales tax or most of the other broad-based taxes, the jobs more or less came back at that point, but the corporate taxes, the jobs stayed gone effectively. Is that correct? Was that your impression as well?
Sure. Senator Myers, through the chair. So I believe one thing that ICER did is they used two different models and two different modeling techniques to look at the short term and the long term impacts. That is one of the issues there. I know in specifically with corporate income taxes, one of the things that they said is that there's a smaller immediate impact, but then over the long term, the impacts are more persistent. And that has to do with you may not cut jobs now, but as you have a higher tax rate, you would over time, that would influence your investment decisions and that would influence corporate revenues and activity over time. And then vice versa, if you eliminate the tax, you may not add a bunch of jobs immediately, but over time that would influence your investment activities.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Klayman.
Thank you. I'm glad you got page four up. One of the interesting parts of the governor's comments were that he described our current tax structure that was very much resource-based as unstable. And yet the plan that he's presented is he's going to what he describes as more stable income sources, but then in 5 to 7 years, he gets rid of all the more stable income sources and goes back to revenue base, which he describes as unstable. And I'm just wondering why, if our problem is that we're going from an unstable method to a more stable method, why we would then essentially drop all the more stable methods and go entirely back to the unstable method. I mean, what's the logic with that?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman. So we asked the same question to the GLO, and the response was that there's an opportunity in 7 years to look at the tax again and determine whether it's still necessary or not. The plan has a sunsetting, and normally, like with the education credit, it sunsets regularly, and you reconsider whether you want to carry it forward or not. And so, the purpose of the zeroing out the tax isn't so much to say it might not ever be necessary again because we're going to 100% rely on oil. It's that we now have this structure in place that can balance the fiscal needs of the state, and perhaps we relook at it and determine whether it needs to be adjusted or maybe sunset or maybe just the rates changed or whatever the legislature deems necessary at that time.
Follow up, Senator Klayman.
But your answer doesn't really say why the governor thinks we should go from a system that he himself describes as unstable to something more stable and then return to unstable. Why is he suggesting we should go, what our long-term path should be, the unstable method of having support for the government?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, if the sales tax were not sunset, then it wouldn't be unstable with a single resource payer again.
Right, but that's not what the governor is proposing. His proposal is we go back to the unstable, and you're not really answering why he wants to go back to unstable. Maybe you don't know. That might be the answer, but I'm trying to get an understanding of why the governor wants to go from unstable to stable and back to unstable.
Through the chair, to Senator Klayman, Janelle Earls, again, acting commissioner. The governor thinks we, the administration and the legislature, need to be looking at where Alaska's at all the time. And it could be that the rates need to go up or down, and that's why it was going to zero. Now, I don't think anybody really wants taxes, you know, anything that is affecting residents' pocketbooks, but if we need to turn that back on when it does go to zero, you know, raise it, see if we need a need for a 1% or something, then we have that ability to do that.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. A couple of points. The highly digitized language, as you know, that was in Senate Bill 130 came from the Department of Revenue. Just to be clear, I didn't make that language up. That came directly from the Department of Revenue. Maybe you weren't there at the time, Brandon, I don't know. But that's where that language came from. And I think when you say it doesn't, other states don't do it exactly that way, I don't know that I disagree with that. Other states have actually a somewhat broader language where they address all intangibles. And maybe that's the solution going forward. And if you're worried about constitutionality, of how other states apply it, maybe we don't say highly digitized, maybe we say it. Intangibles. I think that was an attempt. My guess is that was an attempt at the time by the Department of Revenue to craft something that was a little bit more narrow. And so maybe we need to just expand it slightly and say, make it intangibles. And I'm curious your thoughts on that.
Yeah, through the chair, Vice Chair Wilkowski, I did take a break from the Department of Revenue during the COVID years and when worked for the Internal Revenue Service as the state's taxpayer advocate. So that is the about the time that that was first talked about. I did come back in time for SB 113 to be introduced, but that's why I don't know where that language came from. But I did inquire of my corporate income tax folks, and they didn't know. But they did know where that market based sourcing language came from. It came from them. If we were to look and you asked me today to craft something similar, I might, I don't know what I would draft. It might look similar, but then I would ask, Department of Law to review it, and they would have to tell me whether they think it's constitutional or not. And since the governor has already stated that he feels that there's a question, some questionable constitutionality there, you know, I don't want to misspeak here and state something that he disagrees with. So I just have to say that, you know, we'd have to look at that.
Follow up, Senator Wilkowski.
And we had our legislative attorneys look at the language after becoming aware that the governor was concerned about it. They didn't have any concerns at all with the legality, with the constitutionality. I think I provided that legal opinion on the desk of every legislator. Happy to get that to you if you don't have that. I would like to ask, though,
kind of on Senator Kawasaki's point, a couple other items and maybe why they weren't included. And things that the governor had previously said through his last revenue, well, I guess a couple of revenue commissioners ago, Lucinda Mahoney, she testified that there were a number of items the governor would support if the legislature supported them. One of them was Senate Bill 113, which he vetoed. The other two were lowering the oil tax credits by $3 from 8 to 5. When we passed Senate Bill 21 in 2013 out of the Senate, it passed with a $5 tax credit cap. It changed in the House, very limited testimony, to 8. There's 154 million barrels of oil going through the pipeline, and multiply that by 3, it's a potential to cost us $450 million in tax credits. Your department, the Department of Revenue, testified several years ago in Senate Finance that they did an analysis that cutting those $3 would have no impact on investment. In fact, when Senate Bill 21 passed the Senate, there was universal support for it at the time with a $5 tax credit. Went to 8 mysteriously. And that's costing us potentially hundreds of millions of dollars every year. We had Gaffney and Klein analyze that three potential cutting it from 8 to 5. They said it would have no impact on investment. And that was, again, one of the things that Lucinda Mahoney testified the governor would support if it were passed. Would the governor still support that change if it were put in this bill? And could I get a copy of that document, that analysis that was done? I know I've asked for this multiple times. That document that your department or DNR did, showing that it would have no impact on investment.
Through the chair to vice chair Willokowski, Janelle Earls again, acting commissioner. I don't have any past knowledge on the 5 and 8 any percents or anything, so I would need to defer to Director Spanos or Chief Stickle on some of those items. But a change in any other form, I can't speak to whether or not the governor would accept that or not, but we can find out.
And since that was during that period that I wasn't here, I'm not going to speak to it at all. But if, Dan, you don't have any analysis, feel free to share.
Any further questions? All right, let's move on then to slide 27 and 28, which begins the oil and gas production tax.
All right, again, Dan Stickle for the record. So before we get into the details of the tax proposal around production tax, slide 28 starts with a little bit of background information as a refresher for the folks watching at home. So the state had a severance tax on based on gross value at point of production up through 2006. When we eliminated that tax, the average gross tax rate was up around 7% on an effective basis slope-wide. There was a 12.5% or 15% statewide gross value, but for each individual field, there was an economic limit factor that adjusted that down to a lower tax rate for certain fields. We switched to a net profits tax with a gross minimum tax floor in 2006. That was the petroleum production tax. And at the time, when we switched to the net profits tax, they left a 4% of gross value minimum tax floor as a way of really ensuring that the state would get some baseline share of revenue in a low price environment. There's been several changes to the tax since then. Alaska's Clear and Equitable Share, or ACES, in 2007, and then the Senate Bill 21 in 2013 being the two largest changes. There's been a couple of changes since then, but the Senate Bill 21 has been essentially the law of the land for over a decade now. Slide 29 shows some of the key elements of that Senate Bill 21 tax system. So we have a production tax rate at 35% of production tax value, which is essentially our definition of net profits. We do have that 4% of gross value minimum tax floor. companies are able to apply tax credits based on oil production. There's a $5 per barrel credit for qualifying new oil that qualifies under the incentive known as the gross value reduction, and then a sliding scale credit of zero up to $8 per barrel for all other oil. That sliding scale, the $8 applies at prices below $80. And so at currently prevailing prices for the non-GVR oil, it is the $8 per taxable barrel credit that applies. And then the gross value reduction itself is an incentive for those new fields that applies for the first several years of production. So as a new field comes online, they earn this gross value reduction that's an offset against their production tax calculation and the differential per taxable barrel credit calculation. And as those fields have been in production for a while, they eventually graduate out of that gross value reduction. Slide 30 goes into a little bit more detail on that tax calculation with a high-level overview of how the North Slope oil production tax is calculated. So the gross value is the total value of the oil produced after subtracting royalties and transportation costs. And then the production tax value, or the net profit, is calculated by subtracting company expenditures from that gross value. There's two calculations that are essentially done as a side-by-side calculation. There's the 35% net profits tax based on production tax value, and then the 4% gross minimum tax floor based on the gross value. And the tax calculation takes the higher of that gross minimum floor or the production or the net profits tax. And then per taxable barrel credits can be applied against that tax before credits. If a company uses sliding scale credits for the non-GVR oil, that's the $0 to $8 per barrel credit, there's a hard floor, and the company cannot pay below that minimum tax calculation. However, if the company does not use any sliding scale credits, they forego those completely, then it's a soft floor, and they can use credits for GVR-eligible oil to reduce the tax below the minimum tax floor. So under our current fall 2025 forecast, we're actually expecting most companies to pay at or close to the minimum tax floor throughout the 10-year time horizon of our forecast. We do forecast that some companies will be able to use the per taxable barrel credits for the GVR-eligible fields to go below the minimum tax floor. And this situation really has to do with the price and cost environment that we're in right now. We have a number of new fields coming online that are eligible for the gross value reduction. We're in a relatively lower oil price environment, and costs have been increasing significantly on the slope for operating costs at the same time that companies are spending many billions of dollars in capital expenditures on bringing new fields online. So slide 31, after we've talked about how the tax works very briefly, what would this bill change? So the change is actually fairly simple. It would increase the minimum tax floor from the current 4% up to 6% for 5 years, and then the floor would return to 4% in 2032. There is a provision that allows for a potential for an earlier return if oil into the Trans-Alaska pipeline averages 650,000 barrels per day or more by 2030, then the floor would revert to the 4% earlier. And what that means is that if production significantly exceeds the expectations in the current revenue forecast, companies would get some tax benefit from that. Under our current revenue forecast, the 650,000 barrel threshold comes after the reversion to the 4% in 2032. And then finally, last slide in this section, the bill would also create a new 15 cents per barrel fee on taxable oil production in the state. The fee would be paid along with the oil and gas production tax, similar to the existing nickel per barrel hazardous release surcharge. And similar to that surcharge, no credits or deductions could offset the new infrastructure fee, and proceeds would be used to provide a sustainable and permanent funding source for maintenance costs for the Alyeska pipeline corridor, including maintaining the Dalton Highway. I'm happy to take questions on this section.
Thank you. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No comments on this last one. I think that's a great idea. Governor and I agree on Dalton Highway. I'm sure Senator Meyer has more detailed thoughts. Can we go back to page 30? So I think this is something that most folks in Alaska don't understand. And I'm really glad that you have laid it out like this. I think the degree to which companies can now get below the 4% floor, the floor isn't a floor anymore. The floor is sort of suggestive. And you said most companies will pay at or below the floor, but I'm not really interested in the number of companies. I'm interested in the number of barrels. So how many barrels are going to be taxed below the floor and down to zero? That's my first question, if you can. And my second question is, even at 6%, how close to zero can companies or barrels get? And the last one is maybe a little more hypothetical, but rather than raise the rate, why not harden the floor? What will be the policy cost or benefit of we leave it at the 4% rate, which provides more of the stability that we've talked about. We don't go up and down, but we harden that floor and we stay at where most Alaskans think it is at 4%. I don't think most Alaskans understand you can get all the way down to zero.
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, so there was a number of questions there. I'll take a stab at a couple of them and maybe have to have a couple rephrased for me. So in terms of the number of barrels, we two places I can direct you to. One is we have this table 6-8 in our fall 2025 revenue sources book, and we do break out the expected forecast production from GVR eligible fields. Those would be the fields that generate the $5 credits that could potentially be used to go below the minimum tax floor. Production from those fields is expected to increase as a share of total production quite a bit, peaking at 40% of expected production in fiscal year 2033. And this represents just the massive amounts of new production that we're expecting from new fields like Pikka and Willow. And then as that's kind of the peak is in fiscal year 2033, and then that share of GVR eligible oil would decrease in subsequent years as those new fields graduate into the non-GVR category. As to setting a hard floor, that's certainly a policy decision up for consideration. That would potentially increase the taxes, especially at lower oil prices for the companies that are developing the new fields. But then if you coupled that with a lower gross tax rate, obviously the companies that are not developing those fields would pay a lower tax rate. So that's certainly a policy option to be considered. And happy to address the other questions if you could rephrase those.
Follow up, Senator Dunbar.
No, I think those are good answers. I'm sure my colleagues have more follow ups. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Senator Dunbar was correct. My question is going to be on the fee for the pipeline corridor. So, I'm assuming that since we're talking not just the entire corridor, the entire length of the pipeline, I'm assuming we're talking about the Dalton Highway and the Richardson Highway, and the good chunk of the Elliott Highway as well. Is there any other infrastructure along the way that would also qualify besides those highways?
Senator Myers, through the chair, so that would be something we'd need to get back. We could coordinate with Office of Management and Budget on how the appropriations piece would work. From the revenue standpoint, we would administer the tax and appropriate it to the infrastructure, the pipeline infrastructure fund. I know the governor has stated that the intent is to support maintenance and infrastructure along the Alyeska pipeline corridor.
Okay, and follow up?
Follow up, Senator Myers.
Thank you. Is there, so obviously the state, has run mostly on oil money up until relatively recent history, for most things, but is there a precedent anywhere else in our tax code or anything else in statute where we're directly looking at a specific industry to directly support infrastructure that is open to the public, not closed off to that industry, but open to the entire public if they so wish?
Senator Myers, to the chair, so one example that comes to mind, and my boss might have another example, but one example that comes to mind would be cruise passenger vessel fees, where actually by federal law we're required to use those in direct support of the industry. And those maintain things like dock facilities, and you go down and walk on the docks here in Juneau, and a portion of those have been paid for through those fees.
Follow up, Senator Myers?
No, I'm going to have to think about it. Thank you.
Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. Going back to the original start of the section, you go over a brief history and historical review. I think it's important because some of us have not been here today, and I'm reminded because the older guys, Senator Stedman, Senator Stevens, were talking about having to spend an entire summer talking about PPT with then Commissioner Corbis and Pedro Van Meurs and a bunch of other people. So they did that. We've been through PPT. Then we went through the economic limit factor in PPT. I started when ACES was around. So did Senator Wilikowski. That was, a full year, like 9 months. I mean, it was more special sessions than we've ever had under that, during that time in AGEA. And then we did this next was the More Alaska Production Act and Senate Bill 21. So I pulled some of the old files that I had originally saved from the time that we were there. And I'm looking at slide 29, just the one just before this in particular. And under the goals of Senate Bill 21, it talks about this. It's in slide 11 in 2013. Says enhancing the global competitiveness and investment climate. You've listed that there. Talking about permitting process, structured and efficient, facilitating and incentivizing the next phase of North Slope development. I think it's on there. Promoting the resources and making a positive investment climate for the world market, also listed on here. The one thing that's not is that in 2013, the title of the slide is Securing Alaska's Future Oil. So it says the state's comprehensive strategy to increase TAPS throughput to 1 million barrels per day. And that's not part of it's not part of this goal list, but it was part of the goal list in 2013. I don't know that we're anywhere near a billion or a million barrels per day, but I will say if Senate Bill 21 was contingent on that to get to the million barrels so that we would have revenues coming in as the other things indicate, then maybe we wouldn't be here today trying to balance the budget with a sales tax. I just needed to point that out because that's not one of the bullets that's here. And I don't know who created this slide, but one of the goals of Senate Bill 21 was to get to the million barrels. And it is, again, this is the slide that was introduced to us at the very beginning of session in 2013. Senator Sullivan, Commissioner, Dan Sullivan, Commissioner at the time, Department of Natural Resources, was the presenter. And I got to say, I'm really unhappy that we're talking about fiscal gap concerns and trying to fill this huge multi-billion dollar deficit that we have today with a sales tax, which I think will hurt individuals. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Kawasaki. Anyone wish to comment on his comments? I'll leave you open to do that if you'd like. Mr. Stickle?
Senator Kawasaki through the chair. So, I was around during SB 21. I remember the debates. We have extensive background and presentation on that topic. We'd be happy to bring before the committee. Today we're talking about the governor's proposal, and really intended the historical background as just an extreme TLDR. You point out there was an aspirational goal of a million barrels per day. That was certainly part of the discussions back then.
Thanks.
Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you on that point. There were also a lot of promises that were made by the industry. And there were promises of more jobs, more investment, more revenue, save the PFD. I still see signs around Anchorage saying vote no on changes that were the voters were trying to change to all taxes. And it would save the PFD and save jobs. And
I think it's important to look back that, that there were 15,000 jobs roughly in the oil industry back in 2013. There's now 9,000. There were investments been roughly cut in half. And if you look at Prudhoe, we had, I think, about $850 million of investment in 2013. And it had dropped to as low as around $86 million in 2021, for which they got $720 million in tax credits. I understand it's up now to a couple hundred million, but it's still a third what it was back in 2013. We were promised more revenue to the state, and our revenue has plummeted. We're getting probably a third of the revenue that we should be getting. We were promised it would save the PFD, and of course that has not happened. So a lot of promises were made, and the promises were not kept. And I share the concerns that instead what's happening is the people of Alaska are being asked to pick this up in the most regressive way possible by a sales tax and, as we've seen, the taking of the dividend. Now, I think it's I think one thing we could look at, and one thing which I think we should maybe focus more on, is what's the share that we should get? Now, the Constitution says we should get the maximum value for the resource. And Governor Hammond years ago said, well, it's a third, a third, a third. A third for the state, a third for the feds, a third for the oil industry. Well, the feds cut their share by cutting the corporate taxes down to, I think, 21%. And the state share now, if most of the fields are paying a 12.5% royalty, of which it's not really 12.5% because they get to write off a half a percent or a percent, and we're at the and are paying the minimum of 4% for probably the next 10 years. So when you add those two up and you add on a little bit for maybe corporate income tax and property tax, it's about 16.5%. That's half of what – that's half of a third. Historically, we've gotten – in years past, we've gotten 28 to 37, 38% under ACES. If we simply got 30%, 33%, like Governor Hammond suggested, like you look at Texas and North Dakota, they have royalties on public lands, private lands of very often 25%. They have taxes, gross taxes of 10, 12.5%. That's 35% right there. They've got sales tax on top of that. They've got corporate income tax on top of that in some places. So when you compare us to other states, when you compare us to our historical average, we're getting probably half what we should be getting. That's your budget gap. We got a $1.5 billion deficit next year. If you simply got what we a third of the value of the oil, our budget deficit goes away. You don't have to have a sales tax. Maybe some people would still advocate for that. But I think this discussion of, well, we're going to you know, just start to tax the people of Alaska while we're taking virtually nothing, 4%, and in a lot of cases now much lower than 4%. I hear there's proposals to cut property taxes. There's proposals now to drop the corporate taxes to zero. We'll be giving it all away. So I'm just curious why there's not more of a focus on maximizing the value for our resource, getting a fair share, and instead of taxing the people of Alaska.
Through the chair to Vice Chair Willekowski, I apologize. I am not good with oil and gas taxes at all. So to speak to that, I will have to lean on Chief Stickle. But I just wanted to remind you, this is the comprehensive fiscal plan that the governor has put together. But I will turn it over to Chief Stickle to talk about oil and gas taxes.
Sure. Dan Stickle, for the record, to Vice Chair Willekowski through the chair. I did want to add, we do have an appendix to this presentation that walks through share of profits with and without the governor's proposal, and we'd be happy to go through that now or at another date.
Mr. Stickle, I would like you to do that. I was looking at the appendix, and I think it'd be informative, first of all, for the questions, but also for the public who's listening. Please.
All right. Yeah, so this starts at slide 59, and we actually have a a number of supplemental slides that we've put together. And Madam Chair, we actually based these slides on a presentation that we gave to this committee last year on Senate Bill 92. And so we kind of used that same subset of slides and recreated them here, looking at the current proposal, and we have lots of additional analysis we'd be happy to come back with as well.
Thank you.
So slide 60 is our usual disclaimer we like to give as we go through these oil and gas illustrations. I'm an economist, not an auditor, and so anything I say is not an official tax interpretation. And to point out that we're using aggregate data for this this presentation, each taxpayer has a unique portfolio of investments and production in Alaska, and that is actually more true now than ever, where we have some companies that are very large new entrants and some existing producers that are developing very large new fields and other existing producers that are primarily reinvesting in existing fields. Slide 61 is just a recap of the three main impacts on oil and gas companies that we just talked about, which is the increase of the minimum tax floor, the new infrastructure fee on the to support the pipeline corridor, and then eliminating the corporate income tax. Slide 63, our first slide, shows an aggregate calculation of how the gross minimum tax floor and the net profits tax relate. What we did for this analysis is we used fiscal year 2027 forecast data for our modeling. Under current law, which is the blue lines, the net tax exceeds the gross minimum tax floor at around $72 per barrel. You can see the gross minimum tax floor is in the solid line, and then the net tax, or the gross minimum tax floor, is in the dashed line, and then the net tax is in the solid line. For individual companies, however, like I said, we have companies in very different situations, and that crossover ranges from around $65 to well over $100 for individual companies. With a 6% minimum floor, that crossover would increase to around $89 per barrel, and within companies ranging from around $70 to, again, well over $100 per barrel. And so you can see around the current forecast, we're forecasting $62 per barrel for the fiscal year that we are in the gross tax regime overall in our forecast. Moving on to slide 65. So this chart shows the total change in state revenue under this bill at a range of oil prices and over a 10-year period. And I apologize, there is an updated version of this slide that may not have been to the committee. And actually, that may be slightly, could we get it at ease, please, Madam Chair?
At ease. We're back on the record.
All right. Again, for the record, Dan Stickle. So we do have an updated version of this presentation, Madam Chair, and we will be providing that to the committee. So for slides 65 and 66, there was an error at the $40 and $50 price ranges where the minimum tax was not being shown, and we've corrected that. for some of the other, once we get into the rest of this appendix, there was a slight error in that the infrastructure fee was not being properly counted against federal corporate income tax. That's also been corrected. And then we made some additional changes to the final conclusion slide. And so we'll provide that. Those will be, that's the version that I'll be speaking to. We'll provide the updated slides to the committee. I think for discussion purposes, I think we're good to go.
Very good.
Okay, so again, looking at slide 65, which shows a range of oil prices and the impacts over the 10-year time horizon, we're looking just at the minimum floor increase in the new infrastructure fee in this slide. We see impacts ranging from about $150 to $200 million of additional revenue per year, and then about $25 to $30 million per year after the minimum tax reverts to the 4%. And note that fiscal year 27 and fiscal year 32 have a half year of the higher minimum tax, so those why those are a little bit lower. In general, the impacts of the minimum tax increase go up with price, so higher prices equal higher value. But those impacts peak at around $80 per barrel and start to decrease once you get above $80 per barrel, because more above $80 per barrel, more companies are paying above the minimum tax. So that increase becomes less impactful at higher oil prices. And just want to point out, you may note those odd negative bars at the $70 and $90 scenarios, and we saw those and said, what's going on there? What's going on there is the higher minimum tax actually, while it increases revenue overall, it actually shifts around some of the decision making around when to use carried forward lease expenditures. And so carried forward lease expenditures cannot be used against the minimum tax. And so you actually have some carried forward lease expenditures that would be used up through 2032 that are deferred and used in later years. And so that's where we get those negative bars in a couple years. They're really just an isolated modeling scenario as we run it through the detailed modeling and, again, an overall tax increase. Slide 66 is a similar chart, but layering in the elimination of the corporate income tax midway through fiscal year 2031. And you can see for the oil and gas industry, the bill is a tax increase at all prices for the next few years, but then it's a significant tax decrease to the oil industry in fiscal year 2031, especially at forecast prices and higher due to the elimination of the corporate tax. So the next set of slides we refer to as distribution of profits, starting with slide 68 is kind of an overview of this section. This is also known as government take. So we do an analysis of how profit is shared for a typical barrel of production on the North Slope. There's a lot of assumptions that go into that, and you know we can tweak any of these assumptions if desired to run alternative scenarios. We've based this on the fall 2025 forecast for fiscal year 2027. We're assuming that the production is non-GVR production from state land with a 12.5% royalty rate, and we assume an average level of lease expenditures that we see for companies across the slope. We assume a typical average level of property tax, and we assume the top 21% marginal tax bracket for federal corporate tax. That's a key assumption for pass-through entities. We could use a different assumption, but just to keep the modeling simple, we use that 21 to allow for an apples-to-apples assumption there. For state corporate income tax, we assume a typical effective tax rate of about 4.25%. And we show all of these slides with and without corporate income tax. That allows you to look at the impacts of companies that are and are not subject to corporate income tax currently, as well as the impacts for the companies that are subject to corporate income tax from repealing or lowering that tax rate to zero, as the governor is proposing.
Question, Senator Wilkowski.
So you have a combined 1921 for CapEx and 1564 for OpEx. When you're calculating those numbers, is that based on total North Slope expenditures,
Or is that based on, explain that to me.
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. So these are the based on the average deductible lease expenditures for a producing company. So these are going to be the expenditures that a company can apply in their tax return against a gross value. This would not include investments from a new entrant, and it would not include investments for an existing producer above and beyond the value of the oil that they're producing.
Follow up, Senator Wilkowski.
So what would it be at Prudhoe, for example? I mean, you get 90% of the oil from the legacy fields. What's the capex cost in the legacy fields and the opex costs? It's nowhere near $35 a barrel.
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I don't have those numbers off the at my fingertips. I know that Prudhoe Bay costs do tend to be a little bit lower than slope-wide average. That said, there have been major investments, and I know that is one field that we can and have released field-specific information for.
Thank you. I'll let you proceed.
Moving on to slide 69, so I'll talk a little bit about this chart. We have several several slides that are that have a similar layout. What we show here is the distribution of profits for a typical barrel of oil in a neat little barrel shape, showing this for fiscal year 2027. After deducting all costs, which are the average lease expenditures and the transportation costs of getting the oil to market, we're estimating that there is $19.08 per barrel of profit left. That's the divisible income after all the costs. There's about $19 left. And that gets divided among all the stakeholders, the state government, the municipal government, the federal government, and then whatever's left to the producer. In the baseline at $62 per barrel, the producer keeps about $6.63, or about 35%. The state and municipal governments get about $10.68 per barrel, or 56%. And then the federal government, through the corporate income tax, gets the remaining 9%. If a company is not subject to state corporate income tax, the producer keeps about 36%, and the state and municipal governments get about 54%. So that would be the impact for a, you know, currently for a company not paying corporate income tax, or with the proposal of the 0% corporate income tax, the barrel would look like the barrel on the right. The state corporate income tax takes about 30 cents per barrel of profit currently. That's about 1 or 2%, about 1 to 2% of the total divisible income, and transfers that from the producer to the state. And of that transfer, the federal government ends up picking up about 8 cents of that transfer, because state corporate income taxes are deductible against federal taxes.
Senator Dunbar, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. The lease expenditures, what kind of costs can go in there? You know, is it all the company's salaries? Is it subcontractors? Is it wholly owned subsidiaries? What percentage of the CEO's salary, for example, can they count in there? What's in lease expenditures?
Sure. Senator Dunbar, through the chair. So lease expenditures, allowable lease expenditures, are defined in statute. Generally speaking, these are the direct costs of oil and gas production. So the cost of capital costs on the North Slope of putting in pipe, drilling wells, paying your – and then operating costs to pay your staff and produce the oil. We do have an allowance for overhead. It's a 4.5% overhead allowance. And that rather than taking some share of that CEO's salary and administrative costs and negotiating back and forth over that, we simply allow a flat allowance. So it's 4.5% of the total lease expenditures is deemed to be an overhead allowance.
Brief. Follow up, Senator Dunbar.
Yes, I'll just say that when I don't like the term government take when we're talking about net revenues or net profits, because I don't think most people understand that intuitively. I think an Alaskan thinks, okay, here's all of the money, and then the largest chunk of that stays within the industry. And granted, it doesn't go to perhaps the shareholders, it goes to someone else in the industry. But it still stays in the industry. That almost all that lease expenditure, as you just described, is going to folks that are working in the industry or own companies in an industry, and 4% of it is for people that don't don't even necessarily work on the North Slope or work in Alaska. So again, I think it's a little misleading to say government take as if the government is taking from the total revenues. It's not, because most of the revenues stay within the industry. And I mean, that's what this indicates. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. I just think it's a little bit misleading when you start to talk about government take in a way that ignores the fact that it's net, not gross. But that's not, I'm not blaming you. I just think it's a way that we talk about these things. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Would you like to respond, Mr. Spinoza?
Sure. Just to respond, Senator Dunbar, through the chair. So government take, you know, it is kind of an industry standard term that you'll see.
Yeah, many... I bet.
So we're not inventing that term by any means.
Thank you. Senator Wilikowski.
And just to on that point, these government take numbers, I think, highly deceptive. Because if you're in Texas, they don't get to write off these lease expenditures. Is that right? In fact, they get a 12.5%, 10 to 12.5% gross tax. They get no lease expenditure deductions or very limited lease expenditure deductions. They get a 25% royalty on private lands and most federal state lands. So it's 35% of the gross of the total amount. So if you have $10 billion of oil produced in Texas, the state's getting $3.5 billion. If you have $10 billion of oil produced in Alaska, which is roughly what we have, we're getting $1.6 billion. We're getting half what they're getting in Texas. It's probably less than half what they're getting in those other states, Texas, North Dakota. Highly deceptive. If you want to plug in North Dakota, or rather Norway as an example, and most other states that have net profits taxes, they allow for the recovery of the expenditures like we do, but then they tax at a high rate. You look at most countries that have net profits taxes, we're taxing at 4%. Norway's taxing at what, 78%? So you allow the lease expenditures, you allow complete recovery of the costs, but then they're taxing the total of the profits at 35%, or rather at 78%. And so I look at these numbers, and you know, I've seen government take numbers for years, and I know it's the industry standard. They're highly, I don't want to say deceptive, but they're just flat out don't portray what's accurately happening in Alaska.
Senator Kawasaki, you had a question?
Well, it is sort of more of a comment, but I think it is important to know what those allowable lease expenditures are. And the example, it says property taxes. It's everything. I mean, it is really everything to produce anything indirect or directly ordinary and necessary costs for exploring, developing, or producing oil and gas. And like Senator Wilikowski said, I think the graph also is wrong. I mean, the graph also sort of shows stylized description of what it should look like, but it really is the industry with all of its expenses and however it decides to use its expenses is a big fraction of that barrel, and the state is just a small fraction of the barrel. If you just look at the graph's not really right because it. The percentage is, I mean, well, one, they're just, I think you use the same graphic in each one. So can you maybe explain a little bit more to that?
Sure, Senator Kelly Kawasaki through the chair, and I'd be happy to work with you on why you feel the graph is wrong. Be happy to follow up and go through that. In terms of lease expenditures, you're correct. So the costs of producing the oil do represent the vast majority of the direct costs of oil production. This is the cost that you pay your employees and your service providers and for equipment and materials to develop the fields and operate the fields. So what we're looking at here is after all of those costs are paid out by the producer and after they, you know, pay the cost of getting oil to the market, how much money is left? We exclude the property tax out of the lease expenditures. It is an allowable lease expenditure in the production tax calculation. The reason we exclude it from the lease expenditures is because it is part of the municipal take and the state take. Okay. And so we don't want to double count the property tax in this graph. So we're showing the property tax one time and we're showing it as state and municipal revenue. And so out of the $62 per barrel that shows after the cost, there's $19 left for the various governments and the producer of a standard barrel of oil production.
Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I kind of had this question before we got into the appendix, but I'll go back to it a little bit here. We'd had a little discussion about ACEs and what happened before SB 21. I was curious about it a little bit. You know, you go back to 2013 timeframe when ACEs was being discussed, and I think that was the high point for oil prices, at least since the financial crisis. And if I remember right, oil topped out around $113 a barrel in that time frame. You adjust that for inflation, you're sitting around $156, $157 currently. Current oil price, when I checked this morning, was about $68 a barrel, give or take. I had asked our Ledge Finance Division before session started if ACEs was still in place, given the production and price projections in the fall revenue sources book about how much more we'd be getting. And they estimated somewhere in the neighborhood of about an extra $130 million, which, I mean, is material, but does not close the gap any way, shape, or form. But does that sound about accurate to you, roughly $130 million?
Senator Myers, through the chair, so the comparison of what the ACES tax regime would look like today requires a multitude of assumptions, and there's a lot of changes that have happened since Senate Bill 21 has taken effect. Primarily, we are in a lower price, higher cost environment, and ACES had a soft floor. One of the important provisions of Senate Bill 21 is that it did create a harder floor, and that the per taxable barrel credits for non-GVR production cannot go below the floor. So based on our current revenue forecast, Senate Bill 21 would yield more revenue than ACEs under the 10-year forecast in every year.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stickle. So we're going to stop here. It's a few minutes before 5 p.m. I do want to offer somewhat of a, perhaps call it a balancing comment related to these barrel illustrations. I want to clarify for the public who are listening that our Department of Revenue is not attempting to deceive anyone here with these barrels. What they're illustrating is what our laws say now and what numbers assigned to those laws that we have in place now. This body, the legislature, makes those laws and can change them. It's not the Department of Revenue that is attempting to deceive us or has made the laws they're working with. So just a little balancing there. Thank you very much for being here today. Great presentation. I really appreciated you covering the history of the various tax laws that we have. That was great. So at this time, we will conclude our meeting. The next meeting will be Monday, February 9th at 3:30 p.m. And the subject that day will be Senate Bill 180, LNG import facilities, and possibly bills previously heard. So at this time, the meeting will stand adjourned. Let the record reflect the time is 4:58 p.m.